Welcome to STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM
Talk.
STEM Talk.
Welcome to STEM Talk, where we introduce you to fascinating people who passionately inhabit the scientific and technical frontiers of our society. Hi, I'm your host, Don Kernagas, and joining me to introduce today's podcast is the man behind the curtain, Dr. Ken Ford, IHMC's director and chairman of the Double Secret Selection Committee that selects all the guests to appear on STEM Talk.
Hi, Don. Great to be here with you.
As many of our listeners already know, Ken is being inducted into the Florida Inventors Hall of Fame in November. He joins illustrious scientists and inventors like Thomas Edison and Henry Ford, as well as IHMC's very own Jerry Pratt and IHMC board chairman Bill Dalton. So congrats, Ken.
Thank you, Don, and is a great honor. And I want to point out that also joining me as a 2017 inductee is Dr. Dwayne McKay. He's a member of IHMC's Scientific Advisory Board and is president of the Florida Institute of Technology. It's interesting to note that four of the 28 people who have thus far been inducted into the Hall of Fame are affiliated with IHMC, which I'm bold enough to say speaks to the high caliber of talent that we have for our colleagues.
Absolutely, it does. And because many of our listeners wonder what it is that we do at IHMC, how the Institute came about, and how your path, Ken, less traveled, has led you to work with so many fascinating people in science and technology who we've interviewed on STEM Talk, what better time to invite you to sit in front of the microphone as a guest on STEM Talk? And because there's so much to cover, we are splitting our interview into two parts. Episode 50, which will feature part two of our interview, will upload to iTunes on November 7th.
Well, this should be fun, Dawn. But before you start throwing questions at me, we have some housekeeping to take care of.
We really appreciate all of you who have subscribed to STEM Talk, and especially all of our listeners who helped STEM Talk win first place in the science category at the recent 12th Annual People's Choice Podcast Awards.
Very cool.
Yeah, it was very cool. We also appreciate all the wonderful five-star reviews that have been piling up on iTunes. As we announced in earlier episodes, the Double Secret Selection Committee has been continually and carefully reviewing the iTunes reviews, with an eye towards selecting the wittiest and lavishly praise-filled reviews to read on STEM Talk. If you hear your review read on STEM Talk, just contact us at stemtalk@ihmc.us to claim your official STEM Talk t-shirt.
Today, our winning review was posted by someone who goes by the peculiar nickname THFFH. How does one pronounce this? He needs to buy a vowel. So let's say foof or something, but I am not at all sure how to say this name. However, it's a great review. It's titled IHMC Strikes Again. And the review reads, I instantly became a fan of the STEM Talk podcast. The hosts are knowledgeable and clearly do their homework before each guest. They also are great at stepping back and letting the guests explain whatever knowledge they have to impart to us. The topics and jargon occasionally go beyond basics, but not so far as to be unobtainable for the average listener. Keep up the great work, guys.
Well, thank you. Thoof. And thank you to all the other STEM Talk listeners who have helped STEM Talk get off to such a great success.
Foof is probably a wizard and has given us this unpronounceable name to humor him or herself.
Well, thank you so much for that as well.
Yes, thank you, Foof. And now on to today's interview with, well, yours truly.
Dr. Kenneth Ford is a founder and chief executive officer of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, IHMC, a not-for-profit research institute investigating a broad range of topics relating to building technological systems aimed at amplifying and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience. Richard Florida has described IHMC as, quote, a new model for interdisciplinary research institutes that strives to be both entrepreneurial and academic, firmly grounded, and inspiringly ambitious. IHMC headquarters are in Pensacola with a branch research facility in Ocala, Florida. Dr. Ford is the author of hundreds of scientific papers and six books. He received his PhD in computer science from Tulane University. He is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, fellow of the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence, a charter fellow of the National Academy of Inventors, and a member of the Association for Computing Machinery, the IEEE Computer Society, and the National Association of Scholars. In January 1997, Dr. Ford was asked by NASA to develop and direct its new Center of Excellence in Information Technology at the Ames Research Center in Silicon Valley, where he also served as Associate Center Director. In July 1999, Dr. Ford was awarded the NASA Outstanding Leadership Medal. That same year, Dr. Ford returned to private life in Florida and to IHMC. In October 2002, President George W. Bush nominated Dr. Ford to serve on the National Science Board. In 2004, Florida Trend magazine named Dr. Ford one of Florida's four most influential citizens working in academia. In 2005, Dr. Ford was appointed and sworn in as a member of the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board. Also in 2005, he was awarded an honorary doctorate from the University of Bordeaux. In 2007, he became a member of the NASA Advisory Council, and on October 16, 2008, Dr. Ford was named as chairman, a capacity in which he served until October 2011. He was awarded in 2008 the Robert S. Engelmore Memorial Award for his work in artificial intelligence by the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. In 2010, Dr. Ford was awarded NASA's Distinguished Public Service Medal, the highest honor the agency confers. In 2012, Dr. Ford was named to a two-year term on the Defense Science Board. That same year, Tulane University named Ford its outstanding alumnus in the School of Science and Engineering. In 2013, he became a member of the Advanced Technology Board, which supports the Office of the Director of National Intelligence. The Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence named Dr. Ford the recipient of the 2015 Distinguished Service Award. As I mentioned earlier, in 2017, Dr. Ford was elected to the Florida Inventors Hall of Fame.
STEM Talk.
Hi, welcome to STEM Talk. This is Dawn Carnegis, your host, and today we have a special guest, Ken Ford. Ken, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Dawn. It seems rather unusual to be a guest on this show.
It's a little odd sitting across the booth from you where we're usually bouncing back and forth asking the questions, and now I get to ask you the questions, so this is awesome.
It should be fun.
Yep. So let's start off with a background. So Ken, tell me what your life was like as a child.
Well, asking the former child what they were like when they were a child is a recipe for an inaccurate description, but by all accounts, I was high energy, inquisitive, curious, happy, perhaps annoying. I remember I used to test theories of ashtray aerodynamics when I was a tiny little kid. I somehow had a proclivity to throwing ashtrays. Maybe I was trying to encourage my father to stop smoking.
I'm sure that your parents appreciated that. Sounds like it was meant with good intent. So
it was an empirical undertaking.
So you grew up in Maine, correct?
Yes, I grew up all over the place. I was in Maine in my childhood in Rhode Island, but early childhood was in Eleuthera in the Bahamas, an island. And then I moved from Eleuthera basically from there to Guantanamo. And then I came to the United States around fourth grade.
And all this is because your dad was in the Navy, correct?
Exactly. My dad was a CB, Chief Petty Officer in the Seabees.
And so you talked about Guantanamo, otherwise known as Gitmo. It's certainly in the news these days. What was it like living there as a relatively young child?
It was super awesome.
Yeah.
It's a great place to be a little kid, you know, particularly a kid like me. You know, there were all kinds of mysterious things to explore, and mountains and oceans and lots of swimming pools, which I quite liked, horseback riding. There was military stuff everywhere. What's not to like for a little boy, right? This was a great place.
It's the biggest playground you could have.
Yeah, it was great.
And so once you started high school, you became passionate about wrestling, and that's also when you first learned how to shave off weight by cutting back on carbs. But what drew you to wrestling in the first place?
Well, my grandfather on my mom's side was a very accomplished wrestler, and that probably played a major role in my initial motivation. It just seemed like, well, this is what I should do. However, pretty quickly, my motivations became more internal. As many of the listeners may know, wrestling requires and selects for mental toughness, focus, and drive. And it also builds pride and confidence and sort of a stoic outlook. I got sort of wrapped up in the culture of wrestling. So I didn't just enjoy the physicality of the sport, but the culture that the sport engenders.
Yeah. And also it sounds like the mental aspect of it as well.
you know, it's a sport that involves a good degree of suffering. Even though it's an individual sport, you do have a feeling of shared experience. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to relate to most other sports. If you think about wrestling, you're essentially in your underwear in front of thousands of people with a very strong person trying to hold you down against your will. Yep. And to make you on your back. Well, this is not anything a young male wants to have happen to him
in front of a lot of people.
It's highly motivating.
And you have to have a certain degree of self-confidence to go into that sport, I have to imagine. So were you always interested in science?
Yes. I think the answer would be yes, especially in my really early years. I thought I wanted to be a physician scientist and discover wonderful cures and things like that. And then around junior high, my interest in science waned, partly caused by a couple of truly awful science teachers. And not surprisingly, around then, I became more interested in wrestling and girls and Greek and Roman history and not necessarily in that order, but temporarily lost interest in science.
So I was going to ask if you had any influential teachers in high school. It sounds like you had some influential teachers in high school in the wrong direction, but what about in the positive direction? Did you have any that were particularly good?
Oh, yes. The turnoff from science happened maybe eighth or ninth grade, but from there on, I would say that the vast majority of my high school teachers were very good. I went to a high school called East Greenwich High School, and it's still quite a good school. It's certainly regarded as one of the best in New England, where there are many good schools. And not surprisingly, there were lots of effective teachers there. I will mention just two that made really indelible impressions. On the academic front, Patricia Belden stood out for me. She taught advanced literature classes of a variety of kinds. And these were small, you know, advanced classes. And she was just excellent in all respects and greatly heightened my heretofore negligible appreciation of the humanities and classics. And then second, I would say, and not second in order of impact, but just second to mention, is Arthur Kershaw. He is a legendary coach who served with distinction for many years in that town, East Greenwich. And although his teams were notably successful in wrestling and football and other things, that's not what made him a great coach. He was in a class by himself as a builder of character in young men. Hmm. And that is what a coach is really about, building character in young men and women.
Yeah.
In many ways, I would say he was the best teacher of all, because his lessons were important and they lasted a lifetime. Mm-hmm. You know, you could often hear Coach Kershaw's counsel booming across the wrestling room or across the gym in simple language, such as, "Don't be a dumbbell." Or he would bellow, "Get off your back," as if you needed further encouragement. And of course, he wasn't talking about wrestling only. All right, life gives each of us a lot of opportunities to be dumbbells or not, or to be on our back or not. And his lessons stuck. And more often than not, it's my wife, Nancy, that tries to prevent me from being a dumbbell. And if I'm on my back, helps me get off.
I have to say she does a pretty good job, too.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So so let's kind of step back. So before you became a scientist, you were a rock and roll promoter back in the heyday of rock and roll. So how did that happen?
Well, mostly by happenstance. While I was in college, I was somehow elected to be the student that selects the entertainment that comes to campus that was supported by the students' activity fees. The students were grumpy about the quality of entertainment and the value for the dollar they were receiving. And they'd had one of those unpleasant town hall meetings with the administration. And it was decided there would be a special election and that a student would be put in charge of this, of course, with some degree of adult supervision. So that was me. And I have no idea why they picked me. But I set to work on changing the poor value proposition the students were receiving. And during that process, I met Richard Zimmer, otherwise known as Paco. And Paco was a young professional promoter at the time, making his bones mostly in the Rhode Island market. We immediately hit it off and joined forces and had an impact. So instead of sort of what we had on campus until then, which was sort of kumbaya, hippie, coffee shop music, the students were offered the likes of The Who and Led Zeppelin and the Grateful Dead, et cetera, et cetera. So, and now it's over 41 years ago that Paco was the best man at the wedding of Nancy and I, and we continue to be great friends. And, you know, Paco had a spectacular career in the music business. I very quickly went on to other things, but, you know, Paco was a driving force in the music business for decades. And I know on good authority that he listens to STEM Talk. So, hello, Paco.
Hi, Paco. So I'm curious, was it during this time that you met Jeff the Skunk Baxter, who we interviewed on STEM Talk episode number 36, and who also has a position here at IHMC?
Yes, it was. And as I recall, it was Paco who introduced us. I think Skunk mentions that during his interview in episode 36 of STEM Talk.
Yeah, I think I remember that conversation. So that was a really good interview. And just kind of a funny story for our listeners is my sister actually used to work with Paco through KISS. And Paco's one of the best in the business, as Ken has said. And Ken and I actually figured this out when I first visited IHMC. This is before I was working here at IHMC. And I was actually having dinner with him and Nancy. And he started talking about his former colleague in the rock and roll business, Paco Zimmer. And I was like, why do I know that name? And Ken and I figured out that my sister and Paco knew each other very well and kind of a small world that it might be.
Yeah, so we always say it's a small world, but that was a really strange coincidence.
I think I was supposed to come to IHMC.
Yeah, we'll take no it doubt.
So, Ken, so after your rock and roll years, you enlisted in the Navy.
Isn't that what all rock and roll promoters do? They do rock and roll, and then they enlist in the Navy.
Yeah, that's just typical, right? That's a typical career path. And that's actually what led you to getting involved in computer science, even though you thought computers were about the most unfun thing that the Navy could assign you to do. So tell us about how you trickled into computer science to the Navy.
Well, you know, the short version of that is the Navy is not a democracy, right? If it were, if I had a vote in the matter, I would not have went into computing. In college, I had been a philosophy major with a special interest in philosophy of the mind. And to my surprise, the Navy insisted they did not have any need of philosophers, though it seemed to me they certainly did. After this conversation, they gave me aptitude tests, and as a consequence, they said, well, you are going to study computers for the first 2 years of your 6 years in the Navy, and this was very much against my will. There were no personal computers at the time. You have to imagine, computers were mostly huge behemoths used primarily for boring things like data processing and operated by pudgy, pasty guys behind a glass wall who did not look fun. So when they said, oh, you're going to do computers, I was like, oh, great.
You're going to go from rock and roll to doing that.
Yeah, hang out with the guy with the dimpled polyester pants and the white shirt and the pocket liner with 12 pens.
Yeah. You know?
So I'm thinking, this doesn't seem like a good deal. And it turned out it was a great thing because them compelling me into computation really led to my interest in AI. And it was while I was studying computers in the Navy, I had what was for me an epiphany. And as I mentioned, I had previously been interested in a philosophy of mind. And you might wonder, well, what is philosophy of mind? And in particular, I was interested in how does an organ, like a liver or a brain for that matter, ever give rise to something like a mind? In other words, how can a non-magical physical substrate give rise to a mind which in turn moves the substrate from state to state? Mm-hmm. The two seemed incommensurate. And much, of course, had been written about this for hundreds of years in philosophy. And frankly, from my youthful and perhaps arrogant perspective, it seemed to me that at least with respect to this problem, the intellectual bookshelves in philosophy of mind were somewhat bare and largely bereft of new ideas. Of course, in retrospect, this may have been an unfair assessment, but I think it was largely accurate. So while studying computers in the Navy, I realized that computation was more than a mere analogy, but could, to some degree, be explanatory for cognition and the relationship between brains and minds, much like the relationship between an executing computer program and the computer's hardware. The mind depends on the brain entirely for its existence, but also moves the brain from state to state.
Mm.
So previous to computation, we just didn't have any plausible model of cognition that made sense in the physical world. And then suddenly, to the Navy's great surprise, I became very interested in computers and highly motivated to leave and pursue a PhD in computer science and focus on the relatively young and entirely audacious field of artificial intelligence. So this new perspective afforded by computation allowed me to think thoughts I could not have thought only a few years before, and really shaped the rest of my career.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. So from what I understand, so while you were in the Navy, you did your master's in systems science at the University of West Florida, and then you headed off to New Orleans and Tulane University for your doctorate. And, you know, I have to ask, I've always kind of wondered, how does an ex-athlete and philosophy major decide to get a doctorate in computer science? And you've kind of expanded on this here, but I have to ask you, did people think that you were crazy?
Oh, yeah. It was the universal response. What, you're going to do what? I'm actually used to that reaction.
Yeah.
But it's not as a strange choice as you would think. So from philosophy, I had a strong background in logic, which was the primary language of AI research at that time and still is important. And so it's not as far-fetched as it sounds. When one talks about philosophy, you know, there's the sort of kumbaya philosophy, lots of introspection and what is the good, and that's fine. But that's not the kind of philosophy that I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
But as you note, it was an unusual move, and it was certainly an opportunity for reinvention.
Mm. So after Tulane, you returned to the University of West Florida in 1988 and became an assistant professor in computer science and then rather quickly became a full professor. So I'm curious, back in the 80s and early 90s, what did research in AI look like?
Well, as now, they were really exciting times. The research focus then was, as I mentioned earlier, largely based on logic and semantic representations. It was less statistical in its methods than many of the methods now, but it was great fun and was well suited to somebody with my background. And it was a time when big and deep issues were on the table, and that made it fun.
Yeah.
I sometimes feel sorry for some of the young AI researchers when I go to the national conference, and the work is wonderful technically, but it's a more mature field now.
Mm.
So the audaciousness is toned down a lot as any mature field develops. And there was great fun in being relatively early to the party.
So what was the focus of your AI research back then?
Well, I guess, you know, I was pretty eclectic, but if you had to narrow it down, I would say I had two primary AI research interests. The first being knowledge acquisition and modeling for the purpose of developing knowledge-based systems. And these are really systems whose intelligent behavior depends, for the most part, on the knowledge that they embody. And this was different, right? These were the first computational systems that one could say that their intelligence or their behavior was literally driven by the knowledge embodied in the system. And so to build these systems, you spent a lot of time sort of modeling typically the expertise of a high-performing human. Mm-hmm. And this was interesting and fun. And then the other primary area that I still find interesting, you might call philosophical, logical, and computational foundations, the theoretical foundations for AI. And, you know, some percentage of this was rather argumentative work, aimed at batting down the wrong-headed positions of pundits who would enthusiastically assert that no machine could ever, under any circumstances, be intelligent. And much of this work was done with colleagues now at IHMC, especially Pat Hayes, also Clark Gleemore at Carnegie Mellon University, and James Allen, mm-hmm. among others. And relatively early in my career, I became quite fascinated by a problem in AI called the frame problem. This was first formulated by the late John McCarthy and our colleague here at IHMC, Pat Hayes, who both at the time were at Stanford, and their 1969 article, something like Some Philosophical Problems from the Standpoint of AI, was to me a fascinating piece of work. Mm-hmm. So the frame problem, in a nutshell, is about how to give general rules specifying what things don't change when an action happens in the world. So what happens when one picks up a mug of coffee? Mm-hmm. Something I do a lot. No, my coffee cups are small, espresso cups. Any child could tell you, well, the cup is now in the air, and there's one fewer objects on the table, and that's all. But it turns out that to design an intelligent agent, an artificial intelligence, that can appropriately reach such apparently trivial common sense conclusions is surprisingly difficult. Hmm. And to give you a feeling for what the problem was like, for example, how could a computational reasoner consider all the antecedent conditions that might be relevant to the question of what happens when I lift up the coffee cup? Well, the mug might be glued to the table. The handle might detach itself. There might be an earthquake just then. Terrorists may have planted a microswitch under the mug, which would set off an explosive device. On and on and on. And clearly, there's no end to the list of things that might be relevant, and one can't consider all of them. However, there's a deeper difficulty here, as if that's not enough. That is, with assertions of this type, they're typically drastically underspecify this new state. So it tells us what the action does, but cannot tell us what it does not do. Mm-hmm. For example, picking up the mug does not affect the positions of other things on the table, or the hair color of the president, or the orbits of the planets, on and on. So how then do we infer their values in some future state? So we need some way to infer that when change occurs, all the other changes that could occur don't occur. And this, as I mentioned before, is surprisingly hard to do. And over the years, there's been a variety of solutions proposed, each with advantages and disadvantages. And it's not turned out to be a practical impediment to AI, but it was certainly a very interesting problem and was fun to think about. Mm-hmm. And the first workshop on human and machine cognition was held out in Pensacola Beach in the late 80s at the Dunes Hotel. And the workshop was on the frame problem. And it was from that first meeting that IHMC derived its name.
Fascinating. That's a great history. STEM Talk is an educational service of the Florida Institute for Human and Machine Cognition, a not-for-profit research lab pioneering groundbreaking technologies aimed at leveraging and extending human cognition, perception, locomotion, and resilience. So talking about AI, you are not a fan of the term artificial intelligence. You argue that amplified intelligence is a better way to refer to AI. Can you talk more in detail about that?
Certainly. Well, first, there's nothing artificial about the intelligence displayed by machines. We used to call heavier-than-air flight artificial flight, but no, it really is flying. We wouldn't say that anymore, and we soon won't say it anymore about machines with respect to intelligence. And it's certainly not human-like, but it is, just as heavier-than-air flight is not bird-like, but it is a form of real intelligence. And, you know, for nearly all of us working at IHMC, AI is less about artificial intelligence and more about augmented or amplified intelligence. Mm-hmm. And this is at the heart of what I particularly don't like about the term. So it's both demeaning to any form of intelligence other than human, but also it's the goal isn't for us a standalone homunculus intelligence, but rather how to improve the human condition by amplifying or augmenting our intelligence. So in a sense at IHMC, we're very interested in cognitive orthotics. That is a technological system that leverages and extends human cognition.
I always like that terminology, cognitive orthotic. So Ken, you and your colleague Pat Hayes have for some time said that the Turing test has misdirected the ambitions of people working in AI and also confused the public, especially the media. Can you quickly explain the Turing test and why you think it has become problematic if taken, as many apparently do, to be the goal of the field?
Okay, so here's an abbreviated explanation of the Turing test. In 1950, the British mathematician Alan Turing, genius, when arguing in a philosophy journal for the possibility of intelligent machines, suggested that a suitable test for success would be an imitation game in which a judge holds a three-way conversation with a computer and another human and tries to tell them apart. Mm. So they would both be communicating by teletype. You know, there's no voice clues or anything. Mm-hmm. And the judge is supposed to ascertain which is the computer and which is the human. And the judge is completely free to turn the conversation to any topic, and the successful machine would be able to chat about it every bit as convincingly as the human. So this would require that the machine participant in the game be able to understand language in a deep way and conversational and cultural conventions, as well as have a general ability to reason. And if the judge could not tell the difference after a reasonable amount of time, then we would say the machine has passed the test and it's able to seem human to a human. And therefore, Turing argued that one would be compelled to bestow the moniker of intelligent on it. That's it. But remember, this was Alan Turing, a mathematician, trying to craft a thought experiment that would compel the reader of a philosophy journal to grant that one would have to admit that a machine was intelligent if it could pass this very human-specific and culturally bound-up test. Mm-hmm. This is, you know, perhaps a nice thought experiment for a philosophy journal, and that's where it appeared. But it's not a suitable goal for a scientific field. And I believe that the Turing test should be relegated to the history of science as an interesting footnote, in much the same way that the ambition of imitating a bird was eventually abandoned by pioneers of flight. Starting a textbook in AI with the Turing test, as many still do, seems akin to starting a textbook on aeronautical engineering with an explanation that the goal of the field is to make flying machines that fly so exactly like pigeons that they can even fool other pigeons.
Right. So I'm curious, Ken, AI techniques like machine learning are now used for speech recognition, translation, behavioral modeling, stock picking, robotic control, risk management, so many other applications that it's hard to list all of them. When you first started working with computers and AI back in the 80s, could you have ever imagined this kind of future?
No, frankly. And myself and others imagined all kinds of possible futures for AI, as science fiction writers are prone to do, but with less information. But in general, you know, the application of AI in the real world has been very different than the human-like AI systems that many people were imagining, or like HAL 9000, the fictional AI system in Arthur C. Clarke's Space Odyssey. Rather than creating a HAL-like, singular, all-knowing superintelligence, Modern AI is all around us. It's in your routers, it's in your car, it's in your phone, and it really serves to make everything a little smarter, as opposed to sort of a Wizard of Oz kind of AI system. Speaking of HAL 9000, in almost all fictional accounts of superhuman AI run amok, the source of the hazard is often not that the machine is too intelligent or too artificial, but rather that it's too human. Mm-hmm. So consider the case of HAL 9000. I wonder if there was like HAL 8999. But HAL 9000 was problematic. Its design reflected the old and misguided ambition to create an artificial human. HAL 9000 was passing the Turing test all too well. HAL had failings of pride. It was prone to paranoia. It had passionately held desires. So smart as it was, and it was indeed smart, the stress of life, if you call its existence life, was too much for it, and it went mad. How very human of it. I would posit that nobody would intend to build such a machine, and it certainly won't happen by accident.
Absolutely. And so while we're talking about HAL 9000 from Space Odyssey, there was a story in the New York Times that recently referenced a meeting Elon Musk had with governors where he said that they should adopt AI legislation before robots, and this is a quote, start going down the street and killing people. He also tweeted that AI going rogue was more of a risk than North Korea. So what's your take on that?
Well, one can hardly take such comments seriously. And yet, issuing warnings of the imagined hazards of intelligent machines has become a cottage industry these days. Mm-hmm. I mean, some folks seem to delight in seeing how endlessly credulous the media is with respect to their pronouncements. But this is an old, old story. Folks were very worried about trains, and very similar concerns were voiced, and people postulated that they would be dangerous because they could move too quickly across the Earth. And as many of you know, heavier-than-air flight was harshly scorned for moral reasons, not just technical reasons. And I take Mr. Musk's comments in the same spirit. And frankly, any really remarkable new technology can be perceived as wrong-headed, morally bankrupt, and dangerous. Many things are dangerous. I'm looking around the studio here, and my gaze falls on many potentially dangerous things. And it's about the wisdom with which we use these things. So after decades of pundits arguing that AI is provably impossible, mm-hmm. suddenly that argument has been replaced with the assertion that not only is it possible, but that superhuman AI is so inevitable that it represents the greatest danger ever faced by the human race. Mm-hmm. So in only a decade, a little part of one person's career, the conversation has shifted from you can't do it to you shouldn't do it. Mm-hmm. So when hands are wringing, they're often wrung over an imagined dystopian future in which an AI runs amok and takes over our planet and treats us like domestic pets, or much worse. First, this kind of reference to an AI in the singular is misleading at best. It's akin to saying something like this. Near the end of World War II, the United States dropped a physics on Japan. No, it was a bomb. An application of physics, yes, but not physics itself. AI, like physics, is a field of intellectual exploration, creation, and scientific discovery. One can imagine an endless list of possible applications of AI, and these can be and will be used for good and evil. It's up to us, but we should not imagine that we will find our salvation, as Musk imagines, from our malevolent machines by having the state legislators draft laws to regulate them, or that some kind of knowledge should be forbidden fruit of the human brain and not permitted to be pursued. We as a culture have already taken a huge bite out of that apple.
So Ken, I want to read you something that the co-founder of the Center for Complex Systems Research at the University of Illinois wrote. So this is a quote. There have been at least 27 different species of hominids, of which we're the only survivors. We survived because we found ways to limit our individual drives and work together cooperatively. Human moral emotions are an internal mechanism for creating cooperative social structures. We need to extend this to AI and robotic systems. We need to incorporate human values into their goal systems to create a legal and economic framework that incentivizes positive behavior. If we can successfully manage these systems, they could improve virtually every aspect of human life. That seems like a much more positive view of AI than rogue robots that are marching down the street killing everybody. What do you think?
Indeed. In fact, his comment represents one approach to how we might ensure well-behaved machines. And Brent Venable, a professor at Tulane and also at IHMC, is doing very interesting work on exactly this topic. That said, this does not represent my view and seems again to assume that the goal is to build artificial humans with ambitions, hopes, dreams, and sort of a independent personhood of some kind. All of this is a bad idea in my view. Who knows? Perhaps we will be much better at instilling beneficial moral and ethical frameworks in our machines than we currently accomplish with humans. But I doubt it. One wonders what benefit would be accorded if the outcome, that is the product of the research, was in fact exactly like a human in all cases. Humans do not scale well. Humans are fraught with difficulty. And I would argue that we should design AI systems as amplifiers of our intelligence, not duplications requiring pseudo-personhood and perhaps voting rights. And this is a rabbit hole that I think we should not go down. As humans, we've always rather sensibly wanted our machines to have important inhuman abilities. And you see this from steam engines to calculators. As an aside, one might sensibly note that there are simpler, more reliable, and more cost-effective methods for creating humans, if that were the goal.
Yeah. And this reminds me of a story David Free shared with me. So David is one of our research scientists at IHMC who he recruited about 2 years ago. And he said that after he started working at IHMC, it suddenly came to him how brilliant the name Institute for Human and Machine Cognition was. And he said it's brilliant because you had intentionally placed the human before the machine. Is that true?
Sure. I mean, we start with the human and we work to identify affordances for technological and scientific enhancement of the human experience and human capabilities. But the human is at the center of our efforts. One wonders why it would not always be so. Frankly, I'm strongly biased in favor of humans. I know this view is deeply out of fashion, and there still may be hope for me to learn some self-loathing. But right now, I'm all in favor of humans.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. And I have to say, as we're transitioning to talking about IHMC, I've been so impressed by the range of research that we do here at IHMC. So can you give the listeners an overview of the work that we do here?
Sure. We discussed a little bit earlier, but IHMC is all about developing human-centered technologies in service of leveraging and extending human cognition, locomotion, perception, and resilience. And really, as I mentioned, this should not be a revolutionary idea. One wonders how it ever came to be. The reason we as a species have developed technology in the first place was to survive and extend human activity. And this is really what we're all about. So we work on things ranging from human-centered robotics and exoskeletons to the aforementioned AI, to human performance and resilience in extreme environments, and much else. This research program is inherently interdisciplinary, intellectually audacious, but equally importantly, great fun.
Absolutely. I have to agree with that. So, Ken, here's an audio clip from a video that was produced for your induction into the Florida Inventors Hall of Fame. Congratulations, by the way.
You're quite welcome.
It's a clip of you talking about self-reinvention.
Uh-oh.
So here it is.
People talk a lot about finding themselves, particularly young people, and that presumes they're lost. I think that's an unfortunate way to characterize youth. It's more the case that people take some time to invent themselves, and we're not a static invention. We hopefully will be reinvented several times during a long and productive life.
So, Ken, looking at the scope of your career, it seems as if you've been constantly reinventing yourself. So this is an important part of who you are. So can you talk about that?
Sure. We are all each our own most important invention, and our first invention doesn't have to be our last invention. You know, I've been a cook, an athlete, a rock and roll promoter, a military man, a professor, a NASA executive, scientist. Life is too short to be bored. And I think as we move into the future, we will all need to be autodidactic lifetime learners, you know, people that keep learning throughout life without formal structure to the learning, but it's just continually a process of learning and then reinvention based on that.
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things I actually love about IHMC is that you created the supportive framework that is flexible enough so that the researchers and scientists that are here can also reinvent themselves, and me included. So how did you come up with that concept? Because that's a very different framework than what you normally see in universities and other research centers.
Indeed, and I'm glad you noticed.
and I'm grateful.
Well, you know, I'll spill the beans, but our approach to identifying suitable teammates is pretty non-standard, as you noticed. Our primary recruiting method is that we talk amongst ourselves and identify someone that we think would be a wonderful colleague, and importantly, they have already a track record of invention, but preferably also reinvention already. And then we pursue that person. Mm-hmm. So we try to select colleagues that have high emotional intelligence, that are very technically and scientifically competent. I frankly prefer colleagues that might bristle at any attempt to manage them, but who will accept appropriate leadership. So folks who require a lot of management or do not accept leadership are not a good fit here. We look for passionate, intellectual risk takers who know what it is they would like to do or who are busy inventing what it is they would like to do and would not like to be told what to do, but would rather like to take responsibility for their own success and then set about making that happen. Now, we are not successful individuals. We all work together, but we each take responsibility for our own success or not. So if we were a football team, it would be said that we do not recruit by position. Mm-hmm. Like in an academic department, you might say, well, we need to have faculty that cover the entire scope of the discipline in question. Mm-hmm. A football team needs a skilled player at each position. But we rather always recruit the best available athlete. So we do not have strategic retreats where we conjure up a top-down research plan or identify trendy topics in which we shall then, along with everyone else in the universe, try to recruit a new researcher. Mm-hmm. Instead, we recruit the very best people, and then whatever it is they do, that was our strategic plan. Mm-hmm. So by this method, we are rarely working in an area where we do not have terrific people, and we're never out of phase with our strategic plan because our plan is to do whatever the people here want to do.
Yeah, so one of the things that makes this possible, too, is the flat organization or the flat structure of IHMC, which is so different, again, from a typical university or research center. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Absolutely. We try to have very few rules, not have these big books of rules, but a very strong culture. And one cannot write a big enough list of rules to accommodate a weak organizational culture. Mm-hmm. Culture is stronger than rules. And as you mentioned, we have a quite flat organizational structure without departments or other structures that are determined by our academic discipline. And these kind of structures, though they're necessary in some kinds of organizations, inhibit innovation and reinvention. I mean, for example, I'm a computer scientist. What do you think the computer science department would think if I reinvented myself again?
Yeah, they would not be happy.
where IHMC would be, okay, fine, rock on, dude.
Yeah.
You know, I hope you're good at your new thing.
Yeah, good luck with that. Got your back.
Yeah, so that's really the heart of it.
Yeah. So beyond the research programs of longstanding at IHMC, we're starting to do research on human performance in extreme environments, which I've been working in. As a matter of fact, when you and I first met, I didn't know this and never even thought that you would want to recruit me to IHMC because I was doing human performance and kind of biomedical research at Duke University at the time. So I'm curious as to what brought about the interest in building a human performance in extreme environments arm to IHMC.
Well, as you know, IHMC has always been about working on leveraging and extending human performance and to some extent resilience, but it was mostly limited to computational and or electromechanical means. Mm-hmm. And the relatively recent addition has been to add biological means. Now, why the interest in extreme environments? Well, as you know, we do a lot of research for NASA and DoD, and they regularly put humans in extreme environments. So it's a natural for us. And it's also interesting in that, you know, these organizations tend to put very high-performing humans in these environments, and then they, to some extent, fail. And the failure of the human mechanism in an extreme environment is illuminating. Mm-hmm. And it leads to both fascinating work to mitigate the failure in that extreme environment, but it also often has applications to humans in normal environments. In fact, much of your work, Don, I would say, has this flavor. And then finally, why did we go into extreme environments? Well, I had been thinking about this for some time, but as I mentioned earlier, we don't announce a field and then look for people to work in the field. Right. We look for someone wonderful, and then whatever it is they want to do, that's the field we're in. So you played a big role in us going into that field. And Anil Raj was already on the edges of that field and doing great work here. And so now we've recruited others connected to that area. But we don't move into a field and then see who we can find.
Yeah, I love it. Well, I'm honored. I'm blushing over here.
STEM Talk.
So, Ken, I have to say it was a lot of fun having you on the other side of the mic this time. It's an inspiration, and as I said, a lot of fun to hear about your journey to where you are now. Congrats again from all of us at IHMC on being inducted into the Florida Inventors Hall of Fame.
Thank you, Don. Those were great questions you asked, and as I mentioned before, it's always great fun talking with you. And, you know, I like talking not only about the work that I've done over the years, but I really like talking about all the research that we do at IHMC. It's a great team here, and I'm proud to call my teammates, my colleagues, and friends. And frankly, I hope our listeners enjoyed it and that they have a better understanding of our work at IHMC as well as the topics we discussed.
Remember, part two of my interview with Ken uploads to iTunes on November 7th. And if you enjoyed this interview as much as I did, I invite you to visit the STEM Talk webpage where you can find the show notes for this and other episodes, stemtalk.us.
And this is Ken Ford saying goodbye until we meet again on STEM Talk.
Thank you for listening to STEM Talk. We want this podcast to be discovered by others. So please take a minute to go to iTunes to rate the podcast and perhaps even write a review. More information about this and other episodes can be found at our website, stemtalk.us. There, you can also find more information about the guests we interview.